Reason in Faith and Science was presented by Charlie Dewberry on August 9, 2006, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Faith and Science. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
A little bit about reason and faith and science. And basically, I'm just going to try to make 4 points here, or we'll talk about 4 points. First one, reason's been viewed as a primary authority since the end of the Enlightenment period. However, the nature of reason has been variously understood. So basically, most everyone would acknowledge that reason is our authority, but the understanding of what makes up reason, the nature of it, has been understood differently by a lot of different people in a lot of different ways. So we're going to talk a little about the different ways reason, the nature of reason's been defined. The second point is the acceptance of reason as the primary authority we're going to use has had positive and negative effects on both science and faith, I think. The third point I'm going to make is the most common notion of reason has had destructive effects on science and faith. So the one we're most familiar with, I would argue, has been destructive for both science and for faith. So my conclusion is we sort of need a revolution about the nature of reason. So that's what I'm going to talk about in the next little bit. First, reason in the modern era. And I'm going to take off from Chris's lecture early in the week and some things Jack has said in his lecture as well. But basically, in the medieval period, there were three authorities, and we saw that in Aquinas. We have the scripture, we have the church fathers, and we have the Greek philosophers. And so those are authorities. You can't really hold anything that contradicts any of those sources. Those are going to be your authorities. Well, with the Renaissance and then the Reformation and the rise of modern science and the Enlightenment, that was challenged. And Luther, Galileo, both of them equally were arguing that Greek philosophers ought not to be our authority and the church fathers ought not to be our authority. But actually, for both Galileo, we're going to see, and Copernicus, and the other scientists involved in the rise of modern science, they were happy with scripture, but it's primarily reason. Reason's going to ultimately be our authority. And that's had profound effect on the development of Western culture since the medieval period. Secondly, people started to ask this question, then, what is reason? And this has actually, for me, been one of the most interesting parts of philosophy, because the question, what really is reason? And by reason, the philosophers even that are investigating it have science in mind. Science is their paradigm example. So Descartes, Locke, Berkeley, Hume, if any of those names mean anything to you, those guys are all interested in what is science and how do we know in science? And so in other words, science is becoming our sort of new authority. It's replacing philosophy and theology in the Middle Ages. So what that means for us today is, if you want to know something, who do you go ask? You go ask the scientist. Those are the folks that basically hold the ultimate authority about what's true in the culture. And so the philosophers, as I say, were really interested in understanding what this reason is. And there's there's one view of what reason is. It's still held by, I would say, a majority of scientists. And it's the view that really underlies what we would call science today. So what is that view of reason? What does it look like? And what I would argue is, first, the view of science that I have in mind here is the person who would answer the question, what is science? Science is a method. And by following the method of science, we come to knowledge that's more certain and more objective than we have in any other mode of knowing. So science has more credibility, it's got more objectivity, it's got more certainty, it's a better kind of knowledge than what we get out of any other of our pursuits. Now, what philosophical sort of view of how we know underlies that? And the most common view that underlies that, it came into philosophy of science in the 20th century, largely through a group called the Vienna Circle, and a group that are called the logical positivists. And they got it from David Hume. What does this view really say? What it says is, first, what do I know about an aardvark? If I've never seen one, never heard the word before, what do I know about that? And the answer is nothing. So in their view, we start out and our minds are blank slates, tabula rasa. So how do we learn anything? And this is the most crucial step for them, and that is we get a sensation. And all our knowledge comes to us by way of sensation. What are the implications of kind of having a model that starts there and says sensation is the ultimate grounds upon which we're going to justify all our beliefs? Their thinking is this. In our view of how we know something, a sensation just happens in the mind. The mind's in neutral. So it just happens to us. It's not affected by anything we know before. It's not affected by anything in us at all. Our minds are neutral. It's just done to us. Well, that, in their view, is objective. It's just coming from the outside. So, if we can trace what we know back to that either impression or sense experience or whatever that is, if we can trace it back to here, then we've traced it back to a point where it wasn't affected by any kind of interpretation by us or any kind of biases that we have. It's neutral. The effect of that is then we have objective facts. Those things are objective facts. We know those more certainly than any other kinds of stuff. So, you know, when I see a red color in a particular shape in my mind, I call it in this case a cherry. And that's how all my knowledge comes to me. And as long as I can trace it back to that impression, I can trace it back to something I know with certainty. That's unaffected by me, my thoughts, my preconceived experiences, or whatever. As long as I can trace it back to there, it has greater standing than the other portions that would be affected by my mind, of how I interpreted it or something. So in this view, when you ask, okay, we have a belief, why is it you think you're justified in holding that belief? These people are always going to answer, because my ultimate authority is sensory experience. Okay, so that's going to be their ultimate answer. There's nothing more, nothing higher than that. Okay, but out of this view, and it originally came out of a different view, but it got linked with this view, and it's inherent in this view, is a new kind of doubt. There's a kind of doubt we haven't really talked about here yet. I mean, and that is, the philosophers suddenly said, well, why is it that we think the sensations in our mind, why is it that we think that tells us what the world's like out here? Now, where did that question come from? I mean, that's a new question. The Greeks didn't ask that. Where did that come from? Where it came from was Europe had just gone through a terrible time of wars, largely fought over religious ideas. Lots of people died. And it was fought over stuff that, how can we be certain of? How can we know? And one of the things that came out of it is a movement called skepticism that basically said, look, if you got a belief, in order to hold that belief, you need to be able to tell me on what grounds you're justified in holding that belief. And if you don't have an adequate justification for that, then you're not warranted in claiming you know this stuff. In their view, that would solve the kinds of problems they'd been having. Because a lot of wars were fought over beliefs people had, but nobody could give any justifiable reasons for why they believed it, but it didn't stop them from killing each other. And so the skeptics then were demanding that if you're claiming to know something, you better have a good reason that we accept to justify that belief. So the question became in here, well, why do you think the world outside has any relationship to your sensations? What kind of answer can you give to that question? And the problem is here, you come to a point where you can't give an answer like they want. So the problem is a new kind of doubt results. And this new kind of doubt is basically, we now have this doubt that all our sensations and all our beliefs, we're not absolutely really sure that connects with the reality outside of us at all, or how it connects, we don't know. That's a new kind of doubt. But it's a doubt that affects both science and faith here. And it's a doubt that people who have studied philosophy, that's a doubt they're well aware of. Because like I say, in virtually every philosopher from Descartes, I mean, the seeds of this are in Descartes all the way down. So virtually anybody you're going to read in philosophy, they're either consciously or unconsciously aware of this kind of doubt. So anybody who's studied philosophy, now we got a new kind of doubt we got to deal with. Now, how are we going to deal with this doubt when we think about when the Bible says doubt? What are we going to do with this now? And at this point, we haven't raised that issue. But one of the things that happens here is there's an equivocation. There's a talking past each other. Because anybody who's had enough of the humanities or philosophy, this is the kind of doubt they probably have in mind. And that's part of the presuppositions that they're going to bring to questions about science and about faith. Well, I mean, quite obviously, I'm going to argue from what I've just said that that's not what the Bible means by doubt. That's not a kind of doubt that's addressed directly by the doubt in the passages. I mean, that's something that came centuries down the road. So now, how are we going to deal with this kind of doubt? And so actually, for a lot of people, it's this kind of doubt that's their major worry. And we need to be aware of that. That's just an assumption now that they have that's come out of how they understand reason. Okay, so what are the effects of kind of having this kind of a model on faith and science? Well, the first thing is, in the end result is, science can actually be the only way to know in the end, if you really unpack the thing. Because ultimately, what do we know about the world? What we know about the world is the impressions and sensations that we've gotten. Well, that's science. That's our scientific knowledge of the world. These sensations and impressions come to us when our mind is in neutral. It's not active. Therefore, science is a better way of knowing than any other way we know. The other part of this model is reason is defined very mechanically. So we get an impression. Let's make it sort of our cherry. We have this shape and then a little patch of red color. And so the picture that's put together in the most radical form of this, called radical empiricism, is that these now, we make little copies of them like Xeroxes, and we just store them in our Xerox files. And we can pull them out and mix them all up and make them into new objects. But, I mean, even stuff like unicorns. Hey, that's just a horse with a horn out its forehead. I mean, there's nothing new about a unicorn that we haven't experienced somewhere. We've just put the stuff together. Well, it's this mechanical model. Now, reason has become a mechanical model of getting this stuff, having these pieces, and then all we're doing now is mechanically shuffling them and putting them together and making collages out of them. Reason is that mechanical process. That's what it is, and that's all it is. So the way they're defining it, it's reduced reason to this mechanical process. Now, what's the other benefit of it from their view? Well, if it's this mechanical process, again, it's a machine. I can be certain of the outcome because what's most known to me are the impressions. I am certain of those impressions because they were done to me. And all I've done is take those impressions and now put them together in new ways. So that machinery allows me to be certain and objective about what I believe is true. My knowledge is certain and objective. So if this is reason, then because it originates from impressions that are neutral with regard to any of any biases or any thoughts that we have observers, we're entitled to call these things objective facts. I mean, it's a matter of just opening our eyes and looking. When we open our eyes and look, it's objective facts. Who could deny it? I mean, you know, you look at an animal. It's got two legs or four legs or how many ever it's got, but it's got two legs or four legs. Who can deny it? So science, as these folks see it, is accumulating these building blocks of objective facts. That's what constitutes science. This is the ultimate ground of science. This is the stuff of science. And we accumulate them and sort of build a wall. And in this view, once we get this thing built up far enough, a theory is nothing more than a convenient summary of this information. That's what a theory is. So in this view, science is always progressing. In fact, that's the unique aspect of science. This isn't like philosophy and theology and all that stuff. I mean, you know, the Greeks did it and everybody's been fighting about it since. We haven't made any progress. Some say we go backwards and that stuff. But science, it's always progressing. It's unique in that way. It's always gaining knowledge. And that's a unique aspect of science because of its tie to how we know. So in this view, this is what makes science unique, objective, and this is why it sets on the pedestal in Western tradition and why for the Enlightenment this is going to be our authority. They see it as a means of ending all these senseless arguments. And that's pretty much basically the view of science that they construct. Well, the result is we've got objective facts over here. What's over here? Well, we've got facts and then we have values or opinions or whatever's on the other side. See, because these start with our brains in neutral, there are no values on this side. Because this stuff was just done to us. So, one of the effects is science deals with facts. No other endeavor does. Everything else is opinion and values and biases and culture. The other part of this is, and this is where the more radical part of it comes, is, well, if we're going to buy into this, if sense impressions are ultimately what's real, and that's what we know, now let's come to an abstract term, angel. Well, what kind of sensory experience do we have of angels? The obvious answer is, well, we don't. Well, their claim is that that utterance you're making, angel, it really has no meaning. That's a nonsense sort of word, because we don't know anything about that. It's an empty concept. So the radical versions of this are basically, in the end, saying anything that you can't trace it back to that ultimate impression, if you can't trace it back to that, then the radical version of it would say, then there's no content at all to any concept that you can't trace it back there to. So we know science then by the scientific method, by reason. We're obviously creating now a big gulf between that and everything else. What we end up with is we have science, and some people will call this the arts. But I mean, like the humanities. So, I mean, you know, we talk about this split between the arts and science. There's a big gulf here. I mean, science, I mean, that they know stuff. The humanities, it's kind of fuzzy. It's got a lot of values in it. It's cultural and, you know, we get a lot of different theories about stuff, but they never can ultimately come up with what's true or not true. So we end up with a real split here between art and science. Okay, and then how we claim to know is different in each realm. I mean, obviously in the science realm, how do we know something ultimately? Well, sense experience. Well, in the realm over here, most of the stuff we're most interested in ultimately isn't grounded in sense experience. So you're going to have to know that some other way. And in their, from their perspective, it's not going to have this criteria of being value neutral, because only this means of knowing is value neutral. It's going to be loaded with all kinds of assumptions, biases, and whatever. It's going to be affected by the person that's thinking those things. So it's certainly not going to have the objectivity that science is going to have. So we end up developing a real split between science and faith. Okay, what I want to do in the next few minutes is now I'll give you my short version on why Polanyi is important here. What's Polanyi contributed to this? The first thing he says is this whole mechanical model, that isn't how it works at all. But one of the first things, though, he raises in critique of the mechanical model is this. And you know, let's all of us do this experiment in our mind. All of us go up to Spencer Butte tomorrow morning and watch the sun come up. What do we see? Well, we see the sunrise. But there isn't anybody in the room that believes that. There's nobody in this room that believes it's the sun moving and the earth sits still. Well, if you're going to argue sensory experience is your ultimate authority, then how is it that you don't believe Ptolemy is right? There's no way. The second point he wants to bring up is, okay, now we got a Ptolemaic astronomer and a Copernican astronomer both on Spencer Butte looking at the sunrise. How's this conversation going to go between them to convince each other of what's happening? Yes, it is. No, it's not. Yes, it is. No, it's not. How many sunrises do they have to look at before it's going to get solved? You're never going to solve it. So what he's raising here is sensory perception is not your ultimate authority. So that's the first critique of this. Second critique is, what he's arguing is, which theory you accept is the context that you're going to use to interpret the facts. It's not that the facts are going to tell you which theory is true. The facts are going to be understood within the context of a particular theory. Theory has higher precedent than fact. Theory is going to tell you, in large part, whether these facts are interesting or meaningful. So to argue that science is these facts, accumulation of these facts, and his point is, well, how are we going to understand the Copernican Revolution? There were no new facts. The facts that Ptolemy had were essentially the same facts Copernicus had. Copernicus didn't have any new facts. He was just putting them together different. So how are we going to argue that these are the ultimate building blocks of science and these are objective, separate from what all our preconceived notions tell us about the world? So this is part of Polanyi's critique. The next thing he critiques is, well, look, for all of us, don't we all know that we know what the world is like? I mean, we know there's a world out here with trees and cars and leaves are green. I mean, we know that stuff. You know, where did this skepticism come from? The skepticism was a natural consequence of this kind of model. But yet, how is it that we claim to know? Well, why was it that Copernicus could claim to know his theories true? Well, his theory just made it possible to put so many things together that his response was he had just contacted reality. What was true? What was his ground for thinking that? It was that I've just contacted reality. I know it. Well, this is bizarre to these folks over here. I mean, you just know it? I mean, what kind of grounds is that? What kind of justification is that? Polanyi's argument is this. The mechanical model has never been like that. It's a skill-based model. It's an art. There's no such thing as science in this sense. Everything is art. Obtaining all knowledge is art. It's a skill. Well, let me just unpack this for a minute and first look at a skill. Pick any of them, like Dave playing the piano, somebody shooting baskets. Pick any of those kinds of things you want. What do we mean by skill? And think about the nature of a skill. Well, you start off by practicing, and that is learning a set of rules. And you're going to be clumsy in the beginning because you're trying to do more than one rule at a time. You're going to be clumsy at it. You're practicing. But sooner or later, if you keep practicing, you all of a sudden just do it. You aren't thinking about the rules anymore. You're just doing it. Polanyi is saying, look, it's just like a blind man with a cane. when he first puts the cane in his hand, what does he feel? He feels the cane in his fingertips. But after he uses the cane for a while, it becomes a tool. All of a sudden now he's sensory aware of the end of that cane. Polanyi says here your focus of what you're aware of is moved from your hand to the end of the cane. Well, what he's in a sense saying is, well, see, that was the huge accomplishment of the Greeks. Everybody before them basically used sensory perception. Who but the Greeks could figure out the size of the earth? How did they do that? By using geometry as this tool, as this stick. They could even do astronomy by using this tool, geometry, to stretch out and move where they could know and claim to know past what they could know by just sensory perception. That's in part what the Greeks accomplished. So what Polanyi is arguing is that we need to recognize that it's the nature of obtaining knowledge, that it's skill-based. Well, I mean, the obvious question is, who's skillful at this? How do you know? How can we judge whether somebody is skillful or not? Polanyi says, well, you just have to look at it, and those that are skillful do it well. I mean, isn't that how you judge any kind of skill-based thing? They either can do it or they can't. Well, that doesn't set very well with the folks over here. And it doesn't set well for a number of reasons. Because for them, science was a method. If you followed the method, it didn't matter who did it. You'd all get the same results. What Polanyi is saying, it matters a great deal who the knower is and what kind of skill the knower's got. Well, this is leading to a nightmare. Because what's happening is now we don't have objective criteria to figure out who the authorities are. That's the scariest part of the whole thing to these folks. Now it's getting complicated. But nonetheless, that's Polanyi's argument. And we need to recognize that this is the reality. I mean, his argument would ultimately be, well, think about it. Isn't this the way we all know everything? Isn't it a skill that we learn? And even start with observation itself. Is it not a skill? Okay, there's one other part to his theory that's really important for us. Well, and there's two parts. And one is, by viewing it as a skill, now we're not defining reason as just these little pieces, this little mechanical model of just pieces. Now, everything that we would use in this skill. Jack mentioned intuitions the other day. Intuitions are now part of how we know. I mean, there are rational intuitions. There are reasonable intuitions. Suddenly now we have a complex, robust understanding of the kinds of things that can constitute reason. It's a much richer concept. The other part of this is, and he says it's the nature of all skills. And that is, when you're doing the skill, you're out here at the end of your probe, if you will. You're not actually aware of all the rules and the practices and the means by which you're coming to that knowledge. Because your focus is out here on the doing the thing, learning the thing out here. You're not really paying attention to the hows of exactly the mechanics of how it's working out and how all these pieces fit together. He's saying that's the nature of the beast. So it's difficult. Now, we can pull back and reflect. And here a philosopher like Thomas Reed comes to mind. What Reed was so good at was basically taking these things, Polanyi says, he calls them tacit. We're not aware of them. They're going on, but we're just not aware that they're there and going on because we're focused out here and they happen quickly. Well, but what Reed's doing is going very slowly. And what Reed's doing is unpacking a picture of what the perceptions are. So how do we know by the perceptions of vision, hearing, sense? I mean, he's beginning to unpack what essentially the mechanism is. But Polanyi's reply would still be, well, that's all well and good, and he could do all of that, but he still doesn't have it all because it's just really complicated. But we're just built as knowers, and it's a skill we do. We don't know, nor can we ever give you a complete explanation of why we know this. But he argues we're nonetheless justified in claiming to know it. That's an important claim. So in Polanyi's mind, then, there's actually no split then between the arts and science. Everything is what he'd call in the arts as we've defined it. It's all skill-based. There is no science of this kind at all. That's been a phantom since the beginning, since the development of early science. And his argument is that wasn't what the Copernicans and any of those guys did anyway. They were doing the art side model. Okay, what are the implications here for science and faith? First, there's no defensible split for epistemological reasons. Once you reject sensory experience as your ultimate authority and recognize a rich concept of the intellect in these tacit processes, once you acknowledge and accept that that's the mechanism that's working here, now there's no grounds for the split because it's all on this side. So what's the difference then between science and religion? Well, science is dealing with stuff in the physical world. Religion's dealing with stuff that's other than that, or stuff that's of theological matters that relate to us that, you know, are apart from the physical world we see, touch, smell. We can very easily then just define them that way, but there's no epistemological split of how we would know one versus the other. And then secondly, reason is this much richer concept than just this mechanical little model that, I mean, even this mechanical little model would be hard to see working. And in fact, it kind of couldn't. As Jack mentioned the other day, yeah, they make it a nice mechanical little model, but the only way the thing would work anyway is if you had tiny little people moving these pieces in the right way, making the judgments to put them in the right spots. So the mechanical model wouldn't work without these little people in there actually making some judgments. And the last one is that reason isn't grounded only in sense perception. So once we reject that idea, then we're in a place to now begin to have a much better conversation about reason and its influence on both faith and science. All right.
Okay. Granted, I need to study Polanyi more and try and change some of this, but I was wondering if you could go into that idea of we are just built as knowers and we can't explain it all. We just are knowers.
Mm-hmm.
My gut reaction is to say prove it. You know, prove that we're just knowers. You know.
Well.
And I think that's a result probably of being steeped in the scientific side of things.
Okay.
Forever. So, and I was wondering if you could maybe show me like why I should not say prove it. Like, well, I think you did that, and I might have just missed it.
Uh-huh.
You know, like the general concept of it. But what would uh-huh. be your response if I was to say prove it? And you say I don't have to. Like,
well, you mentioned having a hard time with parts of Polanyi. I just want to say, I read Polanyi as a scientist. Or I should say, I looked at the words on the page, and the first time through, I realized enough to know this guy was challenging virtually everything I knew, but I didn't have a clue what he was saying, and I didn't have a clue of how to sort it out. And 5 years later, I'm not sure I was in a much better position. So anyway, I want to preface it by that. Well, I'd just start out with, come on, Seth. I mean, you started out as a baby in a crib somewhere. And let me just say, you, nor anybody else, is still that baby in a crib. I mean, we're knowers. All of us know a whole lot more than where we started. How can you deny that? They would not view that as an adequate answer to the question. But the response is, get a life. I mean, you got a life. you live life as a knower. From the moment you were born, you're learning about life. Around here we talk about you can be a drug addict and try to escape that and avoid that, but you're still a knower.
Can I
so
ask?
Anyway, yeah.
Okay, one more thing. To trust that knowledge of like, okay, we're knowers, like,
mm-hmm.
I'll try to accept that, you know, like,
uh-huh.
I like the example that you said, but it seems like we have to go through some sort of mechanical process to understand that we're knowers, you know, like, and I think that you were describing that in sort of the idea of like skill, like the skill set that he talks about, how
mm-hmm.
When you go about learning something, you have to go through sort of the methodical process of learning, like, chords on a guitar. Like, you're never going to be able mm-hmm. to play anything unless you understand the formation of guitar. So to mm-hmm. me, that sounds very science and methodical and mechanistic to understand the basis of, like, say, chords for a guitar to play something.
Mm-hmm.
And then you graduate off of that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think earlier in our discussion in there, you said that Polanyi would argue that you don't even need the whole realm of science or that mechanical process to arrive at.
Well, you're using mechanical process in a different sense.
Okay.
See, I would argue that the practicing element, you know, that mm-hmm. focal element, that's mm-hmm. not mechanical. Why? See, a mechanical would be a cookbook. You do this step, then this step, then this step, then this step. In other words, you can write a cookbook of how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But see, my expectation is that with regard to these skills, it's do this rule at the same time you're doing this rule, that you're doing this rule, that you're doing this rule. I mean, that's not a cookbook. That's something else. You can't, well, I mean, you can write a description of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that description isn't necessarily ever going to get you there. Yeah, I don't know how to say
I guess what I'm saying, like, if you pick up a Guitar 101 book and it says, okay, put finger one on this string, finger
right.
two here and three, and then strum, and you get G.
Right,
or whatever.
Okay.
To me, that sounds pretty like...
But see, the two things about it. One is those are the rules, but sometimes you get there by violating the rules, I mean, in a sense. Or the other part of this is, like I say, it's the difference between practicing and doing it. There is some sense in which you have to have knowledge of that, but this is a very different thing than that. So, Jack.
Polanyi calls those maxims, those steps,
yeah.
those rules. And the problem with maxims is that they're only pointers to the sort of thing to do, but they don't exhaust what it is that you are doing or what it is that you know when you're knowing it. I mean, like playing a guitar, the first time you follow the rules, it sounds horrible. So you're not doing what someone who actually knows
yeah.
how to play a guitar with skill is doing, when even though you are following the rules. You know, push this fret down, but you have to learn, you have to teach yourself how to position your finger, what kind of pressure, and I don't even know what all you're learning to make it sound right. And part of what Polanyi is saying is that all learning is ultimately self-learning. You can't transfer knowledge. You can't take what you have learned through experience and just write a few propositions and give it to someone and now they know it. They have to teach themselves. He gives the example of, in medicine, teaching someone to hear a defect in a heart, that they just have to listen to a healthy heart over and over and over and over again until they know not even what they know. They just know, okay, that I recognize now through experience a healthy heart. And then when you have a defective heart, all of a sudden it mm-hmm. strikes them. They couldn't tell you what they're hearing differently. They can just hear it.
Charlie, one of the things that I've done over time is use the model of a mind where I would include what is in a computer called a BIOS, basic input-output system, which are mm-hmm. kind of the principles that are hardwired into my mind
mm-hmm.
that then allow the operating system that's on top of that to operate, and then I can take in information and interpret that information. I noticed that Polanyi doesn't even address those different levels that might be in our mind, including something like, or maybe I just haven't read that yet. And I was wondering if you could comment on where would a BIOS fit into Polanyi's model and maybe even into the current scientific community's model of a mind according to their radical empiricism?
Well, I can do the latter first, and I'll have to keep thinking about the first part. But the latter is, and this is something actually that Jack pointed out to me that we were talking about, is in the radical empiricist model, that if you're going to start with a blank slate, so it's like a computer with no BIOS or no ROM, you know, nothing in the computer that's going to tell it to pay attention to any kinds of inputs or what to do with them or anything. Well, if you're going to start there, the problem with that is what happens if that's your computer? Well, it's never going to do anything. Well, the problem is that's the problem with the human being that starts with a blank slate. I get an impression. Well, what is this? I mean, am I supposed to pay attention to it? If so, what is this? Or, well, maybe it's significant, maybe it's not significant. I got no way to know. So that's where it ends. So it can never get out of the blocks. Now, to answer the first part of the question about the BIOS, well, in fact, part of that is, I think, the chapter that we were doing on chimps and learning. What Polanyi is claiming there, that the difference between the chimp at a point in the youngster was, well, you know, they track along pretty well for a while, and then all of a sudden the human baby just starts taking off, and it's largely language where it shows up. Well, I think his argument would be it's that kind of a system, and in fact it's language in the system of the young child that's this hardwired-in component that's allowing it to all of a sudden make these quantum leaps the chimp can't. And I think that's exactly what he's pointing to in that chapter. And that stuff, I mean, that's all tacit to us. We're not aware of any of that stuff. But he's just going, well, doesn't it have to be like that? I mean, because how else do you explain this? Of, you know, they're tracking along real well, and all of a sudden the chimp's done. But the human's going to really take off.
I'll ask a question, and maybe both of you want to address this. In a world where we're speaking about demonstrable phenomena that constitute the bases for science, and we talk about quantifiable demonstration as being an important criterion there. As Christians, how do we speak of the soul? How do we speak of the spirit? How do we speak of inanimate? And in what sense, how do we talk about what is animate, and how does Aristotle think about what the animal is and the rational part of the animal, and what does that mean, and how should Christians think, and what is a biblical way of addressing that?
Well, I'll take a shot at the first part of that. Where I used to be is that there is an essence to science. Well, I'll put it in Aristotelian terms. It is a kind. It's unique. It's qualitatively different. There's a gap between it and other fields of endeavor like history. So I used to think of science in that sense, that it's a kind of knowledge that's qualitatively different from the other kinds. So according to Aristotle, it should have its own essence that makes it what it is. I now don't hold that belief at all any longer. I don't think it's a kind. Science just differs by degree from history, from philosophy. So all of a sudden, if it just differs by degree, it's a convention. So the boundaries on it are now just conventional. So it seems to me we're faced with a choice here. And this will come back in what we talk about on Friday, because that's actually part of why that Polanyi reading is in there, which I'm sure a lot of you are wondering, what the heck is this? How does this connect with anything? But the question is, okay, well, if they just differ by degree, then we could define science as just what we can experientially know. And I mean, we can even more limited define science as just pursuing the mechanism of how things occur. Well, we can do that, but all of a sudden science now shrinks in its scope. And the real interesting questions are something else. To me, sure, we can define science that way, but now we've made science largely irrelevant for most of these issues. We can do that because it's just by convention. So my answer to that is really that, to start with, that I really don't think there is anything qualitatively different about science. Therefore, I don't really care how we define it. I don't care if we call, this whole question of evolution and intelligent design. I don't care if we call it history. I don't care if we call it philosophy. But it seems to me if we answer those questions completely, it's going to have all those elements in it. So to me, I don't in the end really care how we're going to define it. So that's sort of avoiding your question in a way. I'm not sure I'm answering it, but that's a beginning of how I might answer part of that question.
Your answer confuses me about the question.
Well,
it was great stuff, but I don't care.
Well, and so how my answer connects with that is, well, if you're going to define science that narrowly and those are the assumptions you're going to bring to it, then you're going to end up science being very narrow. However, let's back up now and say, well, okay, are you going to include something like Newton, who gravity, we don't have sensory experience of that, but we have sensory experience of the effects of that. Okay, well, now we're starting to broaden our understanding of what we mean by sensory experience, sort of. Now, what I would say is, okay, now the soul. If we're honest with ourselves, I think if we sit here and we go, okay, what does sensory experience tell me about the soul? And I would say it tells me something in that I can't make a mechanical view work with my experience. Now, it's not sensory experience, but it's experience. I can't make it work. So there's got to be something else. So that was where I was going to connect it.
And therefore, broadly enough understood, is in the realm of science.
Is in the realm of science, yeah. That's how I was going to connect all those dots.
So the only way that, as Christians, that we can really speak to people who are hardline mechanical scientists in that sense is to say, well, that you have limited your way of knowing in this way, and how do you justify then? How do you speak of the rationality of other ways of knowing specifically with regard to this metaphysical component of being human? And did Aristotle attend to that? Did he really have a divide that there was a spiritual aspect of being human and there was an animal aspect, or did he? And how did that work?
Yeah, I think he did.
Yeah.
It just seems to me that that's the biblical worldview as well. That there's that same divide in the biblical worldview. That when you take the other view to its logical conclusions, it really gets silly and laughable, I think. The prevailing view in philosophy of mind in the philosophy departments across the country is what they call behaviorism, philosophical behaviorism, which is to say my brain is just an organic machine and all we have is a machine in various brain states. And what they mean by a brain state is various states of synapses either firing or not firing. And so the famous people are the Churchlands, who take the position that when we talk about fears, beliefs, desires, so on, that's what they call folk psychology. It's sort of on the order of believing in leprechauns and fairies and stuff like Santa Claus and stuff like that. You can talk that way if you want to, and it's kind of cute and quaint, but it's not the way the world really is. The way the world really is there's no such thing as a belief. There's no such thing as a fear. There's no such thing as grief. They're just various brain states that we have decided to call by those names for some reason. Well, it's hard for me to believe that there's anybody out there on the street who would actually take that seriously. Try to convince me that my fear is not a fear.
I mean, I know what a fear is. I'm not, it's not on the order of a leprechaun. It's a reality I live with every day of my life, and it's a real reality. And it just seems laughable to me. Any theory that would come along and say, what I know from my own experience is real and tell me it's not real, there's something wrong with the theory. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a foothold that we can have with people, is take it to their logical conclusion and see if they really, does that make sense to them?
Two other comments. One first along the line of what Jack's saying. Actually, I think probably the best critic of that view that I know of is one of the first proponents of it, Diderot. He was a person advocating this kind of a view, but he acknowledged he was a little troubled defining love as, he didn't call it synapses firing, but he called it matter in motion. Well, that is troubling, to take emotions like love and say that ultimately that's just matter in motion. For a human being, that's troubling. And he even was troubled by that. But he's one of the early proponents that has led to this belief. The other one is, I think we should hold their feet to the fire if they're going to accept that methodology and the scope of what they can actually do. I don't want to hear them talking outside the scope of that, because that's ultimately what really happens, is what they really have to say is about stuff that's outside how they really, in essence, define the problems. Well, in the sense of, they will go on to talk about elements of mind, if you will, that are really outside their model, that they'll make judgments and pronouncements about that. I mean, even maybe, well, that doesn't exist, but they'll make more judgments than that. They'll start telling you a lot of things that are actually outside how they have framed what they're doing.
Similar to what I was saying about Hume or Locke, right, that Hume and Locke will talk about the mechanism of the mind, that it takes in these ideas, and then it will say, and then the mind groups these ideas into categories. Well, how does it do that without a person to tell it whether or not two things are the same?
Right.
I mean, a machine can't do that. Only human beings can do that. And that's the kind of thing you're talking about, where they'll talk about this mechanism, but they'll talk about this mechanism as if human beings are operative in it.
Yeah. If science wants to define everything that it does in terms of what is capable of being perceived by the senses, it seems like there's three ways that it can do that. It can define its subject matter as being the sensory data. It can say its methods have to do with sensory data. And it can say its conclusions have to be sensory data, or any combination of those. I think it's one of the mistakes science makes, is to think that you can't separate those issues out. For instance, I think a good case could be made that about the only thing you can do experiments on are things that produce sensory data, and the only methodology that you can have, the only methods you can use, probably involve tools that produce sensory responses. But I think those two things do not necessarily require that the conclusions that you come to are supernatural. And one of the objections that you have is, if you're going to come up with a supernatural conclusion, well, what's the point of science? Because the way they are imagining it is sort of like, the five-year-old kid comes up to mom and say, "Mom, why is the sky blue?" And she says, "Because God made it that way." And that's what they're imagining. If we allow supernatural causation in there, obviously that stops the whole process of investigating light and whatever. So what do you think about the idea that sort of a positive, it's probably not the case that we could positively prove supernatural stuff, like if science could not arrive at the conclusion God did it directly that way, but it could do it indirectly. And by that I'm thinking, how many people in here do Sudoku? There's several of us. Well, when you do Sudoku, if you're familiar with that, you've got a grid, a 9x9 grid, and you're supposed to, the numbers 1 through 9 are supposed to show up only once, but at least, but once and only once in each column, row, and 3x3 grid. That's the rules. And sometimes you know that the number is supposed to go there positively. You know that this number has to go there because you need a 1 in this column, and this is the only place the 1 could go. But sometimes you know it. You know a 1 goes there because a 2 can't go there, a 3 can't go there, a 4 can't go there, a 5 can't go there. You don't know directly that a 1 can go there, but you know that none of the other ones can. So you've eliminated all the other possibilities. And so the only thing that's left is a 1. And I think that in that way, science is able to determine that there is a supernatural cause because every other natural cause is eliminated. And so that's actually what I think a more profitable direction to defend intelligent design is to say it is exactly the same thing as a forensic scientist is doing, a detective, investigating a dead body. And the first thing he asks is this an accident or was this murder? Did this happen by chance or by design? Did an intelligence purpose this particular death? Or did it just happen? And scientists don't, I mean, the majority, the scientists that are saying intelligent design has no place in science have no problem with the detective using forensic science to determine it was a murder as opposed to an accident, accidental death. And it's no problem when we're talking about a murder to say, okay, was it the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker? And finally he comes up, he says, it was the butler did it. You know, of these five suspects I investigate, first I determine it was a murder. And then if I can't determine who the murderer was, that doesn't change the fact that it was a murder. And if I determine that the murder is actually my son, it's not valid for me to go back and change my mind and decide, oh, no, it wasn't a murder, it was an accident, just because I don't like the perpetrator that I happen to come up with. So we've got this situation where it's not a body we're investigating, it's the origin of life and diversity. And so one can use the same forensic approach to look at the data, exact same approach, to look at the data and say, was this an accident or did somebody do this? But the trouble is that once you've determined that somebody did it, the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, and the butler are no longer around to do it. The only intelligent agency available at that time had to have been a supernatural being. Now, intelligent design does not say directly a supernatural being did it. It said an intelligent being did it. But as a matter of fact, the only available agent at the time we're interested in is supernatural. So what do you think about that as a way to approach how a conclusion about a supernatural entity might in fact be provable from science? And if there's a problem there, how would you articulate the problem? Or how would you anticipate, if you don't see a problem, how would you anticipate the scientific community who might not want to, you know, just by fiat wants to say, nope, no supernatural in any way, shape, or form. How might they respond to that?
Go ahead. I'll let him think. Yeah. That's the argument that most evolutionists use about evolution. Mm-hmm. They take it for granted that God didn't do it. So when you come along and say, you can't give me an account of how evolution happens, their argument goes, well, it did. That's a fact. I mean, human life in diverse forms developed. That's a fact, an undeniable fact. We know God didn't do it. So just because I can't give you an account of how evolution did it, we all know that evolution did it.
But
that's not an uncommon argument in literature.
Right. But why did they say we know God didn't do it?
Oh, well, I
by definition.
Just by prejudice.
Science has to, by definition, not admit of that possibility.
Well, I think even some of them in an unguarded moments are not even defining science. They're just saying that's passé. I mean, that's old-fashioned.
That's
superstition. That's silly. Yeah. So they're using exactly that kind of reasoning in that direction. I don't have any problem. I think we use that kind of reasoning on all the time. It's what I call transcendent logic, where you take something that's known, and then you say, well, what story can we tell that accounts for the facts as we know them right now? And you come up with the best story you can to account for all the facts as you know them right now. The logic of transcendental argumentation is not that you have demonstrated necessarily that that's the case, but what you're saying is, here's a story I can tell that explains all the facts. You got a better story? If you don't have a better story, rationally, this is what I ought to believe is true right now, because it's the only story I can tell that accounts for everything that I have in front of me, that I know. And I think that's what a forensic scientist is ultimately doing, is that they're constructing a story of what must have led to the pieces of data that they have. And I mean, there are other stories that could get told, but what they're depending upon is the jury, in their common sense, is going to go, well, I don't think the Martians came down and planted that bloody glove there. I mean, you could tell that story, but it's not a plausible story. So what you're depending upon is that people will acknowledge that reality probably is that story which is plausible and accounts for all the things that I have, that I know. And your point is a good one. Okay, so what if that story requires a supernatural being? So be it.
How do you account for it having to be supernatural? Why can't it be? And if you're speaking to someone who's coming from a strictly naturalistic background, wouldn't ID be more plausible if the intelligent designer was actually natural in some sense, as opposed to metaphysically undemonstrable?
Well, many evolutionists at time, including Francis Crick, at points have pointed to a possible intelligent sort of agent, meaning he talked about aliens at a point, that there wasn't enough time for something to happen. So, I mean, they're going to propose, and the thing most readily available to them would be natural agents. So some kind of natural agent did it. So, yeah, they do point at those kinds of things.
I don't think intelligent design says that they were created just as they are. I don't think intelligent design rules out changes over time within populations.
Mm-hmm. Well, Behe is explicit that he believes in origin from one. What's the phrase he used?
Descent with modification.
Common ancestor.
Actually, if you read Darwin, who is drawing largely upon Lyell's work in geology, uniformitarianism, that the uniform processes at uniform rates and things, if we just allow enough time, that will account for this. One of the interesting aspects of this that most people don't realize is both Lyell and Darwin, they see uniformitarianism only going so far. It never explains the origin of. So notice that the title is The Origin of Species. Well, what does he say? Well, you start with a species and get another species. But the starting point is a species, is the point. So the point is, this isn't about origin of life at all. And in fact, both Lyell and Darwin say that's not a scientific question, because uniformitarian is not a method that could answer that question. So Darwin makes that argument in Origin of Species. And so it isn't about origin of life at all, according to Darwin.
How do you reconcile, say, the fossil evidence of early man, like those things you read in National Geographic where they've got those skulls and they do the little shaping and this is what it looked like and this is probably what they did and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you reconcile that and, say, dinosaurs with the Genesis account? Like, that's a huge question in my mind. Like, I just don't know how it works.
Well, first, let's start with the first part of this. There's a story being told about, say, Australopithecans, which is a genus. Now, the first argument we're going to have is that man or man-like. Because the first thing we need to decide here is, well, actually, what's a man? Because if we don't decide that first, before we get into an argument about a particular case, this thing is likely not to go anywhere of significance, it seems to me. So you already come in with the preconceived notion that you have this descent with modification. You already come in with a preconceived notion that the difference between all of those genera and man, it's all just a continuum. There's no real difference between them. We just arbitrarily define them that way. So first, you're coming in with arbitrary categories to start with. So my problem is, even just telling that story, I mean, you may have one, in some cases, it's one or two bones, and you're reconstructing an organism and talking about what that organism does. Well, I mean, can you do that? Well, that's not unlike what Margaret was talking about as a method. You're taking your available evidence and weaving a story. But let's be honest, you're not starting with much. So, I mean, my first reply is, it seems to me that we ought to dig our heels in really quick before anybody tells any story and stop and say, well, just help me out here. You know, how do we know that a particular individual thing is a man versus an ape? I mean, let's start there. Because what I would argue is you're not going to get much of an answer. The answer you're likely to get is, if we have a skull, well, we measured the brain cavity, and it was of such a size. So again, we're going to come back to measurement. So the ape doesn't have as large a brain as a man. Well, so if the capacity of this skull is this big, we're going to call that a man and this one an ape. Well, maybe I'll go along with that, but maybe I won't. So anyway, my problem is I want to dig my heels in before we even start on a process like this. So anyway, that's my first reply. I mean, you know, it's just their presuppositions. They've got a story to tell, and you make the facts fit within your theory. The first thing I would note about the Genesis account, well, the first thing I want to address is sort of historical and chronological here, as well as let's deal with six-day creation right now. We have to ask Moses, was his intent here to tell us science, or in this case, history? I mean, is that what he's doing here? He's saying, my goal here is to tell you the early history and the origin of life. Okay, well, we have to make a decision about that. My quick reply to that is, I'm not convinced that that's Moses' purpose. I mean, his purpose isn't to tell us about chronological time. At this date, at this time, God did X. I don't see that is what his objective is. So if it's not that, then it broadens the possibilities, at least, about what he might be doing. And it seems to me that there's more at issue with regards to who God is and what God's doing and what the connection is here between man and the rest of nature, for instance, when he gets to the end. That it's more about those relationships and roles and the natures of these than it is giving me a historical account. If you're going to take it that it is chronologically based, then for instance, one of the biggest problems for me is if you're going to claim 24-hour days, how did you land on a 24-hour day when you have a day before you've got the sun? I mean, you know, you can solve that simplistically, but it seems to me there's actually a deeper problem there. Is why have we decided, you know, because the obvious question would be, well, we've decided a 24-hour day. Why? Because of physical, the earth, you know, the earth turning, going around the sun. Or, yeah, the earth turning with respect to the sun here. Anyway, so, I mean, it strikes me at least there's real issues there. So I guess what I want to say is with the tools I bring to it at this point, I think there's some real hard questions here, and the tools of exegesis and my understanding of language aren't forcing me to a point where that's the only option available to me. I have more options. Another piece of this is just my experience. Now, when I look out at the world as far as I can look and see and experience, my problem is it looks pretty old. I mean, we have cases in Montana, for instance, where you have 2,000 or 3,000 feet of sandstone with fossils in it at 5,000 feet that are marine. And there's a cliff, and it's kind of aimed up this way. And 10 or 15 miles away, you have a matched set of these layers, a couple thousand feet thick. And everything in between is gone. Now, it's possible that a cataclysmic flood may have done that sort of thing. It's possible that the Nile Delta is only, you know, X amount of years old. But that isn't the conclusion my experience would sort of naturally take me to. Or we're receiving light from stars, that if the light actually came from the star, it would have had to start a billion years ago to get here from what we know now. So the fact that we're getting light from a star, that the light had to travel a billion miles to get here, I mean, that's suggesting to me that it's old. Well, you could respond, well, God just created it old, you know, but it's actually young, but it looks old. That's a problem for me, because that seems deceptive. And that seems out of character. So, I mean, those are the kind of questions I'm going to bring to Genesis 1. So, what I am going to get from Genesis, there is a chronology of what got created. And the interesting thing to me is the order of the biology is, in fact, the same order that evolutionists would sort of argue. With regard to mammals, it starts out with fish and goes on. Well, both sides say the same thing about that. So it strikes me that sort of the elements of the biology, there's some fairly parallel accounts. So the issues between them are, one, if it isn't about chronology per se, but it's about roles, then it seems to me that a Genesis account could be compatible with certain scientific theories. In other words, do dinosaurs make it impossible for me to essentially make compatible dinosaurs with the Genesis account? Well, if it's not a chronology, then I think it's not that difficult for me to make those compatible. And so with regards to any of that kind of information at this point, there's nothing that necessarily, it seems to me, I can point at that necessarily contradicts what's possible. So, I mean, that's the best answer I can sort of give. But I wanted to sort of take that circuitous route at the beginning just to say, I mean, I think these are really hard interpretive issues that there's an... It's a complex, really difficult issue. So, but I think if we recognize, if we accept the posit that it's not chronological history, then we have a lot more flexibility on what it's being done there, and is it in fact, can these two accounts be compatible?